Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella, the space where we talk about all things creative arts therapy, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. The goal of this podcast is to create a space where therapists, caregivers, and students can learn about the creative arts therapies, find resources to support work, and just make more connections. I love encouraging listeners to try an episode from a modality that might not be your modality. It's amazing what you can learn from other therapists who are also really creative, but who are outside of the discipline that you engage in. If you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. It helps us become more visible to other listeners. Today's episode features Brittany Tachkoff, who is a music therapist working in end-of-life care. She shares her experiences working in hospice, about creating her current position, she dives into an awesome concept called creative credit, and she shares about her recent music therapy course release through musictherapyed.com. Brittany is a wealth of knowledge, so don't forget to check out the show notes and enjoy the episode. All right, Brittany, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We just had the wonderful chat pre-recording, and I was telling Brittany that I think I need to start recording before and after because so many good topics come up in those short amount of times. It's awesome. Yes. Okay. Well, do you want to dive right in to our Would You Rather for today?
Yes, I'm ready. Okay,
awesome. I decided to go with a self-care related Would You Rather, and because my technology was acting up, and I think we decided it was meant to be because it's going to be a good transition. So this was one I had asked this on Instagram a few weeks ago, and I did a self-care theme on that one. And this is one of the ones that came up is, would you rather take a nap or meditate?
Ooh, this is a hard one because I do both.
Yep.
Recently, take a nap.
Nice.
Depends on when in my career. There are times when I've chosen meditation and there are times when I've chosen naps, but I actually took a nap yesterday in my car because I work in hospice, and that's what you have, your
Been
mobile
there.
Office. And it was one of those where I almost didn't take a break and I was just feeling exhausted near the end of my Friday. And I just needed rest. Meditation wouldn't have been appropriate for me at that time because meditation means staying awake and attentive to what's happening. I needed to rest. Set a timer, 5 minutes, close the eyes, and just let the body sleep. So take a nap.
Awesome. I love how you explained the difference because that is so nuanced too of knowing, like, I think sometimes we know that we need to like slow down, you know, it's like, okay, my body's telling me I need to bring it down. And I think there's a lot of like stuff that's like, oh, you should meditate. But like sometimes being awake is still, you're taking an input. You're working when you're meditating, you're working on clearing your mind. But that difference of like, nope, my brain needs to shut down completely. I love
Absolutely.
That. Yeah. Yes. I thought with this one too, I had a hard time because I also do both. But I feel like you explained it so eloquently that really tuning into those very minute differences of like, do I need to fully rest even for 5 or 10 minutes in my car? And then I have the weird lines when I go into my next session on my face. I think I had a seatbelt one time because the seatbelt was there. I was like, oh, great. And then sometimes it's like, no, I kind of need like a reboot. Like I still have energy, but I just need to like refocus. And then those are those great meditation times.
Right. And I think a lot of it is reading that energy level. So when I have just like, I feel like I'm bubbling with energy and it's all up here. I need to hone that in. And I think meditation is really good for that, for me, to bring that focus and grounding and what's in front of me right now versus here are all of the things that mm-hmm. I will do today or this week or this month or this year.
Here's my giant to-do list.
Here is my bubble of, and there are other places that I put that. So right now I am working on a visual, I guess I'd call it a dream board. I'm not sure if that's the right term because it's not, I think some people have different images of dream boards. You might think mm-hmm. like the cork board and you're like putting things in there. I use the backside of wrapping paper and roll it out. And I just start writing, drawing, doing different things. So what it looks like so far, because this is a work in progress, uh-huh. It's based on the masks that I made first. So if you've ever done this intervention, it's more like that art-based. Mm-hmm. But I've done this with children where you have the mask and on the outside is what you show to others. And on the inside is how it feels. And so I did that for different roles in my life. It came in a pack of six. So I just decided I have so many hats I wear. We can figure out six. One of them is me. I had to decide in the end, like, what would be the culmination of me? Mm-hmm. And then, me as a teacher / leader, me as a professional, me as a student, me as a family member, me as a wife. So I have my six masks that I already made, reflection on the inside, outside, and then I'm making 5-year timelines for all of them. Because if I focused on one mask, I know I could make anything happen. Mm-hmm. I know that I could dive in and maybe never be seen again by other people, especially if it wasn't one of the family masks or like the friend masks or mm-hmm. one of those communal masks. Yes. I would just disappear uh-huh. into whatever I was focusing on. And I was trying to realize like, well, actually, I want to be thinking about my life with all of my identities in mind. So looking 5 years ahead, what would I want for each of those? And then if I see them all lined up, right? This is why you need a big piece of paper.
Yeah.
See them all lined up next to each other and think, how would those work together? And what would be the step at year one to move towards a five that could also wow. align? Mm-hmm. And not that it's going to be a perfect process. I don't believe in like writing this down and then being like, if this doesn't happen, means that I failed. No, it just is mm-hmm. giving that sense of direction.
Yes.
Also giving a sense of direction that is balanced.
Yeah.
And then you can keep rolling out the paper. So as I keep rolling out my my roll, then I have it color coded so that I can write out words under each of my masks. So mm-hmm. words in this color are related to this dream. Words in this color are related to this dream. Mm-hmm. And then I have a Venn diagram of me trying to integrate wow. different things. It's turning into, and that's something that I'm going to be doing this weekend because it's in progress. It does not have an end destination.
Totally.
And there's definitely can continue to roll out. Soon I'm going to just take over the whole bedroom. The great thing is that you can roll it back up.
Yes.
You can just fit into this nice little place because what I was finding when I was using more of the some of the creative methods, particularly art-based or things that are making something that's concrete, that takes up space, mm-hmm. is, okay, soon I'm not going to have any walls left.
Yes.
White space is good. I don't want to just clutter my living space. I also, have my husband here, mm-hmm. have a dog. The dog takes up plenty of space, owns the house.
yep, they do.
I don't want to be taking all of these projective tools mm-hmm. and taking over, I want it to also be something that I can put away and I don't have to think about. And that part boundary. Of that is healthy, right?
Yes. Yeah. Honoring that boundary. I love that. Cause then it is like, I would feel the same way. And I, even within that in itself of like you were saying, like diving in and getting lost, I feel like I could also do that in that project itself where I'd be like, okay, by 12 hours and you know, it's gone. And then, but having something where you could roll it up is like, okay, I'm going to honor that time to reflect and dream and, you know, think of my goals for the future and put those down. But then I also need to step back into where I currently am and be present and then roll it up and it's like gone, you know, like I love right. that boundary of that.
Yeah.
That is so awesome. So I have a question because this is, I think this is such a cool intervention. It's such a cool like self-reflection process. I feel like this would be an incredible thing for students, interns, mm-hmm. learning, like building your clinical identity if you did it as like a smaller clinical piece. So and it's more clarifying, you had masks, like the traditional kind of masks that you can make, like they're like the paper mache masks.
They're just these white masks that you can get mm-hmm. on Amazon.
Awesome.
Yes. I don't know if they're paper mache or not. They're just white on both sides.
Yeah. And then you had those different identities. You kind of whittled down to those five. And then you have the culminating one that's like the holistic one of all right. of those pieces. Okay. And then on the wrapping paper is kind of where it's like your brainstorming sheet of like, what does mm-hmm. this look like next year? 5 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Like that's where all of that brainstorming happens.
Yeah. And you can actually lay out the masks. So I lay them out on top of, mm-hmm. like, they're basically all in a line, and then the timelines are coming down from them. So every time I bring it out, I bring out the masks.
Yeah.
And that creates that.
That is visual. So incredibly creative and such a cool idea. I love that. And it could be applied in so many ways for just your development and like thinking. I feel like that's a great way of integrating the pieces of yourself, you know, like, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's Jungian, whatever, I forget which theory it is, but you have like those parts of self mm-hmm. and finding a really nice way to integrate them. And they're all like, I love how visual it is. I'm a really visual person. So you can just mm-hmm. see it all. And that is awesome. What a cool project.
Yeah.
Very cool. I feel like that's a great, for me, I think that would be a really great self-care piece of getting all of those things in my mind of like, what do I want this to look like? And putting them down feels like such a great decluttering of the mind exercise.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I was kind of hinting at that when I was talking about meditation, right?
Yes.
Sometimes there's all of that and it's all being held in this mind space that feels like it's at least five times larger than my head. that's how I'm holding my hands right now. You won't be able to see it. And then trying to work towards how do we put this somewhere without having it feel limited. And I think that's what has made me hesitant about sometimes trying to create timelines and five-year plans, and because sometimes it can also feel limiting. Okay, if I need to do this on this year and this on this year and this on this year, and I've fallen in love with ambiguity. I've fallen in love with not having things fully defined, and to a certain extent we can do that, right? We don't need to define every piece mm-hmm. of our life, and we don't have to explain ourselves to everyone around us all the time. And there are times when we do. So there are times when we do have to figure out how are we going to define this, at least for now, so that there's an understanding, especially when we're trying to go in a direction in our yeah. lives that involves working with other people, whether that's coworkers or with family or peers.
Yeah. I love that, that balance of, you know, knowing when there are times when defining things or, you know, having operationally defining something currently just for a temporary time is really important to get to a direction or a goal. But that, you know, even I feel like it happens all the time and it's just life of you may define that, but the goal may end up changing still. And it like, it might create a path, but that path might lead somewhere else. And like, there's that ambiguity, even though that definition helped you get there in a way.
Right.
Yeah. That is amazing. I love that. That's incredibly creative. And I feel like it's a, you know, I've heard some art therapists talk about like the, I've heard of the mask kind of idea, but I love the wrapping paper so, so much. I also, this is super weird, but writing on wrapping paper is super satisfying. Like if you have a good pen or a marker, it's just like, no. So yeah, when you said that, I was like, whoa. Oh man. Well, we were kind of talking about this beforehand too, about creativity in general and, how, it can feel sometimes like we're not, you know, if we go through our days, it's like, man, am I really being creative or what is creativity for me? What does that look like? How has that experience been for you?
Well, as we talked about before the recording, I agreed to be on this podcast, and then I had this moment of, what am I doing? I'm not creative. Am I creative? Can I be on this podcast? I'm not sure if I fall under the creative umbrella. Yes, I am a music therapist.
100%.
It feels like that should be inherent, and there's that moment of, like, what is creativity and what does that mean? And a lot of it has been learning to give creative credit. And what I mean by that is sometimes we start with someone else's idea. That's how we learn in the creative expressive arts fields. We learn from someone else. We're given intervention ideas. We're building a toolbox, we're building repertoire for music therapists, we're building up these ideas. And then as we go along, and this doesn't happen overnight, but as we go along, we start modifying, we start adapting, and we start collaborating with the client that is in front of us. And so what might start as an idea that we've learned from someone else then builds into a creative idea that is technically our own. It's still the origin. We still have to give credit to other people. When I was thinking about this podcast, I was thinking about all of the shout outs I'd be doing, like, oh yeah, with this thing, I learned that from this person, but then I did this. And it's just like the masks, right? The masks are not a new idea. That is not my original idea. It is definitely something that I learned. And then for my own personal self-care, I adapted it to something else. So I think trying to give ourselves that creative credit that we don't have to create something out of nothing to be part of that identity.
Yeah, that's such an important thing. I love that. I love the term that you, that creative credit is such a great way to say that. And like a, such a, because it's a, kind of this concept that I feel like we're not always familiar with. And as creative people, like that you can feel so like, oh, well, I took that idea that I saw that idea on Pinterest and then I just changed it a little bit. Like that's, that's not my idea, but it's so true that like we're standing on the individuals before us with an idea, but we're building and exponentially growing that into something totally different for clients, for ourselves. And that is deserving of credit and of ourselves too, to honor that. I think that's also a self-care piece of honoring that as well. Yeah. I love the label for that. That's so great.
And then how many times we're creative and it may not be within that clinical piece. So I've dived into being involved in both the California Task Force and then the California Association for Music Therapy. I was one of the founders. And creating an organization again, not an idea from scratch. There are other state associations out there. There are other 501c3 nonprofits in the state of California. We needed to look. We needed a guide. You wouldn't just want to create out of nothing when you're trying to create structures. At the same time, there's a certain amount of creativity to keeping it going, to what kind of officer structure do we want that makes sense? What can we do to invigorate ourselves within this process and try and reconnect to why we are doing this and why we are volunteering our time? So I've seen that there can also be a lot of creativity within structures, and a need to fuel that and to reconnect with that piece of it.
Yeah, that's so important to that creativity isn't just that classic thing of making music, art, dance, drama. It's not just that realm. I actually remember talking, I think I talked about this with Mika McLean. She was episode 4 mm-hmm. about creating a business. And it takes so much creativity to look at, and you're going to look at previous structures, but mm-hmm. you're adapting creatively to your needs, your clients' needs, the state's needs, how your organization is set up. And it takes so much creative process to sit down, and especially with other people, you're brainstorming, what is the best fit? How can we look outside of the box for our needs, and what can that look like?
Right.
Yeah. We were just doing this yesterday, actually, at my job for an internship program, because we had looked at the other kind of structures of different internship programs, because just coming up with one would be so arduous, and it would be like, why reinvent the wheel if you don't have to? But right. we were taking ideas from several different kind of structures, and then just brainstorming, like, how would this look for us? What would it, and it was like this whole creative brainstorming session, but there was no music, no art, you know, it was, we were just hashing out ideas.
That's not part of our, yeah. Sometimes it's not right. Sometimes, yeah. Especially since in this, like, to state association level, you know, we are not all in the same room even. So trying to do creative through our video call, it's we can, and sometimes we do, sometimes we harmonize, but
oh fun. That's great.
But it doesn't mean that we're gonna do that as part of creating ideas. And I love how you're talking about at work too, because I had to do the same thing of trying to integrate a music therapy program where there hadn't been a music therapy program before. So then I have to look at, okay, what is social work doing? What is spiritual care doing? How do I create documentation system, a documentation note in our electronic record when there is no music therapy note that exists? So, and how do we adapt some of the things that you can find in books? There are, you know, written out assessment forms for hospice. How do you make that into the electronic record that is meaningful? There are a lot of different things, creating the internship program, all of those things where it's like, these things don't exist, yet they do exist. We are not working in this isolated bubble. That's one of my passions as well. I love to expel the myth of us being alone anywhere. If you have access to technology, you are not alone. Number one, even if you don't have it, you still have ways of talking to people. And in that sense, you actually have all of these, it's like all of these people are standing behind you, or we're standing on their shoulders, whatever image works for you. There are all of these other people that can help inform and tune you in to your passion and your direction. And so I have 2 supervision groups right now that I'm a part of. I, of course, was very passionate about connecting groups of people because I wanted an organization in California. And I found that when I was starting to feel stuck, there was always someone I could go to, whether that was my previous supervisor from internship, or just reaching out to someone that I might have met at a regional conference or at a training, or even on Facebook. When you don't have much of any relationship, I would like to say that most music therapists and most expressive arts therapists would be pretty open to you sending them a private message with a question.
I do it all the time.
as far as I know, so no one would say, sorry, I can't help you. Depending on what you're asking for, of course. But if you're just asking for advice, and if you give something that is like a concrete question, so instead of asking for them to maybe like do something for you, but just asking for that advice of, I'm trying to decide between this and this, or I'm trying to figure out a direction. Do you know someone who may have information on this? And pulling in all of that, and then being the creative person that takes the pieces and puts them together. Mm-hmm. That is a lot of where I have found my creative identity. And then I also see myself doing creative things. And then there's also like original things that I create all the time. And I need to give myself credit for that.
Yes.
And that might not happen every day, but that's definitely happening and has grown, especially when I reflect on what it was like when I was an intern to what it's like now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely changed.
And like, I think that identity, that like, I guess creative identity maybe, as that develops too, like it's part of a clinical identity, but I think it's also part of a personal identity. And it takes a lot of work to really reflect on how that changes and what that looks like from an intern to a very young professional who's 6 months into what they're doing and terrified. And then to, you know, a more seasoned professional. And I remember feeling too, getting involved in, I was the webmaster for the MAR region for a couple years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, at first I kind of like doing some techie stuff. I like doing some really weirdly, I like editing stuff and like bold underline, you know, two returns, like just really, really mundane stuff. But I like it when it looks really great when it's done. And I was like, I remember feeling like, wow, this just isn't really creative. Like it's not a creative endeavor, but you know, it's for, I want to be a part of the association and support. And, but as I was doing it, I was like, oh no, there's totally creative ways of like pulling in creativity to this and making it, seeing the creative process, like as it, you know, as I went through it. And it's really fun to look back and integrate all those pieces and then imagine where that goes in 5 years, you know, where that identity is going to be. Yeah. So I have a couple questions for you because you talked about your current, is it your current place of work that did not have a music therapy program beforehand? Can you tell us a little bit about what you currently do and then maybe like how you started that program?
Yes. So I work at Hospice of the East Bay. So I work in adult hospice care, wherever someone calls home. So in the home, in facilities. We also have a 6-bed inpatient unit called the Brenn's House, and it's really a privilege to have that because in our county it is the only one. And that's not the case in other parts of the state. California, it's just a lot harder to have an inpatient unit financially. And the program was started through the Thomas Long Foundation grant that they received. And originally that grant was going to fund music and memory. And it did fund music and memory and getting a music therapist. So I work with music and memory program in a hospice setting, which is different from in a facility. I work with threshold singers. And then, of course, I work on the interdisciplinary team. And starting that program, I started it in May of 2017. That's when I came on board, and it was really starting from mostly scratch. They actually had a pretty good job description, and this is when I'll give the shout out to Russell Hilliard, who knew the VP, and then also my manager worked for Seasons Hospice previously. I actually came from Seasons Hospice before I started this program. So the job description was very accurate, and that's a big thing that was exciting. Yeah. You actually know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And you know what you're doing. So that was about all that we had. Other than that, it was about building in both structurally, but also how do you fit another discipline in to the dynamic that is an interdisciplinary team? So we have other disciplines that use music, primarily spiritual care counselors. And that ranges depending on their level, comfort level with uses of music, because sometimes that looks like live music, sometimes that looks like recorded music. And I've done a lot of learning what does it look like for other disciplines and volunteers to use music. And I have to tell you that it's really awesome.
Yeah.
We need more people. We need more people to be using the creative arts. Now, as long as they're not calling themselves a music therapist, and as long as they know when to reach out to me, and that was my biggest thing. So with music and memory, I don't know the number, but there are many volunteers trained to use the iPods with the playlists, and there's one of me. Okay, so I cannot go and assess every time before music and memory goes in there. What I can do is work with the volunteer department to say, if a volunteer reports this, this, or this, I would like to be contacted and notified. So there is one case where someone heard their preferred music, they broke down into tears, and they couldn't function for an hour after listening to music. They wouldn't eat, they wouldn't stop crying, and this is outside, you know, our volunteer can't necessarily do the holistic assessment that we can do. So I go in, and I want to assess first by talking to the family, you know, what is their history with music, what are their reactions? What are they usually feeling when they're tearful? Because we don't want to assume either way. Either assumption is bad. If we're always assuming that it's sadness, then that's a problem. If we're always assuming it's happiness, it's a problem. But I was assessing through the family. I'm assessing through the caregivers. This person was in a boarding care, so it's a house with caregiving staff. So I'm assessing through them, and then I'm seeing what kind of music the volunteer was playing, and then I'm bringing in live music, but I'm also using recorded music in that session to see how are we going to respond. And what I found was, number one, tears were related to positive emotions. The Giants win, crying. Something's beautiful, crying. See someone you love, potentially going to cry. So there was a history of actually positive emotion. But as I've been studying in marriage and family and child counseling, if there's an impairment, that still means that it's an issue, right? So even if it's a positive emotion, if there's an impairment, we still need to be looking at it as if it's something that needs to be addressed. So then I'm looking at, okay, we have these things that are very positive emotions. We don't want to take that away. We don't want to take away the music that is creating these positive emotions, but we do need to transition out of that emotional state to something that is more neutral. So identifying the music that was neutral, and then making sure that the music and memory volunteer had that music and ended with that music. And then having the music therapist, of course, still involved to continue to assess and just be part of it. And it actually turned into, you know, then the patient also would reach out to the keyboard and play the keyboard while in bed, and, you know, all of these other things that could be explored with music therapy that may not have happened without music and memory identifying and even triggering the impact of music for this person.
That is, I think, the most beautiful story I've heard that encompasses the that concept of creativity moving beyond, how much we want creativity to move beyond just creative arts therapists, and not armoring, but, you know, giving that knowledge to others that can be out there and utilizing, and even other creative arts therapists, but then, you know, volunteers who are practicing within their scope. And you've created such a that's such a really great concrete way for a volunteer to know, when am I out of my scope, or when did something happen that is out of my scope to handle and that someone else should be notified. That's such a great just story to encompass all of that in such a beautiful way. And how much, what a beautiful opportunity that might not have been there had there not been a music volunteer, you know, the music volunteer, that program. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of stories like that that I could share, but I don't want to just take up the whole time telling.
Oh, I love it. Yes. Yeah.
Also because I want to move into the other thing that I do a lot in my work, which is multi-generational family work.
Well, yes. Yeah. Tell us about that, especially. And this is interesting too, because now I have no idea. I know a little bit about this in music therapy. I've never done it, but I've read like some more research and different programs coming out. But I have no idea how this applies to other creative arts practices. So, explain a little bit about what that looks like and what you do with that.
So in hospice, it's a family-centered model. So that means that you still have to have the client, who's typically the patient. They're the ones who are signed on. They're the ones that are consenting to care. And then there is typically, or hopefully, a decision maker. That might be someone legally through is what's called DPOA paperwork, or an advanced healthcare directive, who's chosen to make decisions once that patient can no longer make the decision. It could be a next of kin family member. Sometimes it's a parent, because remember, adult is 18 and over. So I've worked with as young as 19 to as old as 106. So there's a really wide range in there. And then there's whoever that person calls family. That could be their neighbor. That could be the biological family. There could be a, you know, legally married or just a partner, whatever, whoever they call family is family. And what that leads to is a very wide range of what you may walk into. I really tell people, because hospice has its own connotation, just like music therapy, and hospice is really anyone and everyone who has a life-limiting illness, and for adults that means 6 months or less, can be on hospice. So that means that they could also have a mental health diagnosis. They could also have any range of a disability or additional needs. And it also could mean that there's just a lot of medical shifts that are happening that are now creating disability and creating those changes. So that also means that the family could be anyone. And they don't have a life-limiting illness, and they're now going to become the bereaved soon. They're going to be the ones who are living with this loss. And when I add that into the mix, I've worked with as young as three purposefully. So there's kind of some of it can be more purposeful, and some of it can be more indirectly including. So if we go with indirect, I think I've had like 18 months like in the house, mm-hmm. and holding an instrument. Am I actively working with them on goals? Not necessarily. Especially in those cases where developmentally they're under the age of 5. It's not currently within my scope to be working on something like that. Also, when you're working with someone who's under the age of 18, we have to be thinking about consent because, and even with family, we have to be thinking about consent to treatment because none of the family members signed up for therapy. None of the family members signed up for hospice. Even if it was the decision maker who signed their loved one on to receive care, and that has the additional benefit of support for the family, we do need to be checking in and making sure that they want the support first and foremost. And when it comes to anyone under the age of 18, we need to make sure that their parent wants and what kind of support they want for their children. So we can have them play an instrument at the bedside, and that's okay. They could make drawings. They could engage in a lot of these creative arts in a free-form way without a goal in mind that can still have side benefits for the patient. So we're thinking about the patient's goal of connecting with that child. When we think of it in that framework, there's a lot that we can do without saying that we are treating them. They were happened to play a drum at the bedside, which happened to increase the patient's ability to be with the child, grandchild, great-grandchild. That is okay. We are not doing anything to the child other than they are playing an instrument. And that is not us doing music therapy for them. Now, in other cases where I have had frank conversations with a parent of a young child, that's when we might go into the work of have they heard the words death, dying, cancer? Have they heard the right terminology? Have they heard the concrete language that all children really need? And is the parent okay with that? When they say, I'm okay with you working with my child, does that mean that we can speak frankly to them? Does that mean that we can disclose information or not? We need to be very clear on that. And that's what a big preface to working with multi-generational family members is that we need to know what is allowed and what's not allowed. So I've had the one case that comes to mind where I don't have that consent. The patient themselves is the parent. Does not want their child to know that they are dying. By the time I get in there, they're pretty close. They can't verbalize necessarily anymore, and they can't have sustained interaction with their child anymore, but they are not being told. Their sibling doesn't feel comfortable because that was their last wish, was to not tell the child, and at the same time, it is happening. It's going to happen. So what can we do then when we're trying to support them? Well, fortunately, we have a lot of creative modalities. And what we can do and what was okay was for them to bring their toys into the room, play instruments. The sibling can identify songs that we can do together. And then the sibling can use that now that they've seen, now that they've been in the room and they've been comfortable in the room, I later learned that that sibling was able to talk to the young children. There was a child and a nephew, and then was able to use that as a jumping off point of how did it feel to be in that space? What do you think is happening? That's always a great question. Check for their understanding. A lot of times they know so much more than we ever give them credit for.
Yes, they do.
And we just need to ask them, what is your understanding? And the other thing is we want to be using concrete language, because sometimes they can be creating an entire story that is partially based on truth of what they've seen. Yes. And then the other part is their imagination. And their imagination is oftentimes can be potentially more harmful to their grieving process than the actual information. So I've had people think that the oxygen that we use when someone is starting to get short of breath was going to blow them up like a balloon. And no, it just helps them breathe. And if we don't tell them and we don't ask them, we aren't helping them understand that this is helpful. This is not harmful.
Yeah. And that traumatic piece, I think, for children of their, you know, that imagination can be a powerful tool to understand some of the what they're thinking and what they're piecing together. But to know that, you know, like disassociation for children can be so easy in a place that it's such intense grief. There's not understanding what's happening, and it's all based in fear. And then that becomes a, like, that trauma response. You can just go back and forth into that trauma response, which can be so dangerous if there's not some of that concrete language to ground the child into what's really happening within their age, their appropriate age of understanding. Yes. Yeah. Wow. That's so incredibly powerful and such intense work.
It's also my favorite work, which is why I then sought more information by going into my master's degree with marriage, family, and child counseling. Yes. And I can give you an example of how I already started integrating it within maybe the second quarter of my grad school. So there's a family systems class, and we create a genogram. So if you don't know what a genogram is, you can easily find it. Mine is a poster board of it. They're fun to make. You should go make one for yourself.
Yes, you could use wrapping paper.
I used a poster board at this point, but you know, whatever material you want to use them. But, and I did like 3 or 4 generations. So it's really looking at all of these really like family influences, right? When you're looking at, all of the different family members going back however many generations. And then, you know, you can include, you know, religion, you can include level of education, you can use all of these different kind of cultural and personal identifiers. And something that I don't formally write out, but that I think through in my mind now, is the music genogram. So when you're looking at multi-generational sessions, you are no longer looking at one person's music. And actually, I would say that one person's music is also a genogram, because you have to think about not just what their generation, what they selected for themselves for preferred music. You also have to think about what was their parents' music that they heard in the house when they were growing up, and what of their parents' music may have been their grandparents' music that was used to sing to their children to sleep every night. And then when you're looking at a patient, you may see that their children influence some of their preferences, their grandchildren influence their preferences, and then there even some who have the great-grandchildren. All of that is really going to come in, especially when you're working with multiple generations, which really could just be, even if you have one person in the room, your consideration of musical context And a big question that I ask, which I have to try and reword sometimes, is what is the exposure to music? Not just what's the preferred music, but what is your exposure and experiences? Because that is going to be a really big influence on the session. So when we're thinking about multiple generations, we have someone, let's say that the patient, and then we have a child, and then grandchild, and then we may not have their parent. But let's just think of it in three generations. So we have this person who may have influenced their child in a song that they sing to the grandchild. If we can find that the music that goes all the way through, that is going to be a powerful and meaningful experience that then we can change into an intervention. So let's use the music therapist's favorite song, You Are My Sunshine.
I know. It's like, okay, maybe You Are My Sunshine.
You Are My Sunshine, as much as we may or may not have our relationship with that song, it is oftentimes a multi-generational song. And I know it was in my family. It was my great-grandfather's song that I ended up singing to him at one of his birthdays when I was young. And I have found that if the family is having a hard time finding that song, that is one song that I may offer up as an option. And so what do we do with the song? Now, whatever that song may be, it's not always that song. Sometimes it's this other obscure song that I have to go learn. But let's say it's You Are My Sunshine, because it has come up quite a bit. Now we can transform that into a few different things. So if the patient themselves can sing it, can we get permission to record them singing it for the grandchild to have? If the patient is no longer responsive and the grandchild is at the bedside, I can give you the example of, I think they were around 10. That was the song that came up. And sometimes even when I ask kids, what song do you know? Sometimes that is a song. It could be Moana. It could be Frozen. It could be Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And sometimes You Are My Sunshine comes up. And so then I asked this 10-year-old, what words come to mind when you think of your grandparent? And then we could change the song. And the reason I'm going to use You Are My Sunshine versus creating an original song, which sometimes I do as well, is because then the grandchild can sing it for their grandparent. And we can do that at the bedside, and the parent is taking a video and crying. It's all beautiful.
Yes. And so I love to like capturing that on video. You know, if that's captured on video, that becomes a legacy project.
Yes.
I work in palliative care. So lots of, I'm like total flipped where I'm working with children with life-limiting illnesses only up until 18.
Yeah.
But very multi-generally, we're bringing in their siblings, parents, grandparents, and legacy projects have been the most mind-blowing thing to witness, to create, to pass along sometimes. Sometimes they happen after the fact where, as a music therapist, we might have all these like small recordings that we took. And if somebody passes unexpectedly, it's like, okay, I have all these random things. Can I make a project out of this? Mm-hmm. And then that is that continuation of healing or connection that happened in the moment, and it like just continues to ripple, and it's just so beautiful the way that that can continue. It's such an important piece for, I know, so many parents, children who grow up and still have those pieces. It's mm-hmm. just such an important moment that's captured.
And there are other ways to do that as well. So this is mm-hmm. with people who are willing to be a part of the creative expression. Mm-hmm. We are not going to expect this out of every patient and family ever. That doesn't matter what population. We don't expect. We create opportunities without expectations. That's a phrase that I use so often, whether it's something I tell my intern or the family that I'm working with. How do we create an opportunity without an expectation? And so when it comes to legacy, I also take the approach of what can we do in one session? And then if we can create something else, the next session, or build on that, or continue it, that's wonderful. But what can we do in one session? And what I've found is a few different things that also work along our multi-generational family piece. One is songwriting. Taking that, how would you describe, or what words would you use? And flipping that into a spot songwriting. So I do it in the moment. I have no pre-chosen chords or melodies. I just take their words. The great thing about that is that I don't have to mention songwriting or legacy before I do it. I just go into a room, especially if there are more than, let's say, two people at the bedside, because I've gone in and there's 10 people. How do we make this meaningful to the people who are in the room without them starting to leave because they feel like this is a private moment? Sometimes that's appropriate. Maybe that primary caregiver, that child, or especially that parent or parents or spouse, maybe they do need that to be a private space within music therapy. But sometimes there are 10 people in there and I'm introducing myself. This especially happens at the inpatient unit where they seem open to it. They don't know much about what I'm going to do necessarily yet, but they know that I exist. They endorse me coming into the room. Here's 10 people. What do we do? And especially I would say when the patient is unresponsive or unable to communicate, I tell families a lot that I know that this is not representative of who they are and I would like to know about them. How would you describe them? And I do not have the best memory. So this is when I start pulling out my phone and I apologize and I say, I'm going to be writing a few things down. and it's really because if I don't write it down, I may not remember it. And I really want to remember how you describe them. So I will write it down and I will have all of these different words as much. It's all word for word. Sometimes I just miss some of them, but it's all their words. And if there's 10 family members, then I will ask, can each of you pick one word? And then, you know, they may be able to pick more, but that way I'm making sure that every person is included. And then depending on how that person is described, depending on their connection to music, also depending on how much the family is already using music. So I've come in and there's a son who plays already for their loved one and they're doing all of the right things and they don't need me to come in and play the same music. Some people will want that kind of support. They want someone else to lead that for them. But why don't we empower the family to also take on that role and then consider, okay, I'm the music therapist. I don't need to do that part that's within my job description. Is there another role that I could take on for them? And sometimes this kind of songwriting is that role. So getting all of those descriptors, and then I often will just say, let me know if I was hearing it right, and then I'll just start singing it. Depending on how the space feels. So with that room of 10, typically you can just do that. There's already a lot of voices and stimulation and auditory and But you do have to be able to feel the room. You have to feel the emotions. Does this feel like it's a very private space where you need to ask permission? Does this feel like the person is that close to dying that you may not, this may not actually be appropriate without family permission to make that meaningful? And then offering versus doing. It's very much feeling into that family. And that's something that I still feel like I continue to learn, and going back to getting additional information on families and family systems and marriages when working with couples and children, and digging deeper into that child development, digging deeper even into trauma and how that works with the system, or substance use. So when we have someone who comes on and it's alcohol cirrhosis of the liver, and that's what's killing them, how does that feed into a family? And how does that influence our legacy decisions? So legacy can be a very powerful, positive tool for families to have something concrete, whether we have a hand in it or not. You know, sometimes I will encourage the family to take the video versus me. I don't feel like I need to be in it for them to have that all 100% of the time. I try and get out of the way as much as possible as a music therapist. I'm learning about myself. So where is it that you don't need me, and where is it that you need me? And where do we walk that line together? But there are times when we may be making something, and as far as the patient's goal goes, 100% this is going to be helpful for them in their release. Now, are we aware of their dynamic with their children who may be receiving it? And will the children want it? And will the children look at it? So I have also found that even with good relationships, sometimes people have waited up to a year before listening.
Yes.
There also may be people who never listen. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And just honoring that that is okay.
I had a family member that I made a legacy project for, who she explained it really well, and I'm going to fail at replicating her words, but she had just said, knowing that I have that is just a really important, she, you know, it was something like I couldn't go there, but knowing that I have that is more important than, you know, experiencing the legacy project. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge eye opener to like the role of those projects sometimes, is it's sometimes it's not the what it is, but it's that like it's a piece to hold on to. Right.
Mm-hmm. And that it's there whenever they're ready.
Yes.
And maybe they're never ready, and mm-hmm. that's okay. Mm-hmm. But they have it. Mm-hmm. There's also people that I learn later, especially if I end up playing at their memorial or funeral or being a part of that, and that sometimes happens months later. I've heard of people who, when it's the audio recording, they play it in their car every day to work, and they have especially their loved one's voice. And this is where I almost want to segue into legacy when it's not music-based. Mm-hmm. There are music-based legacies, and they are beautiful. And for some people, 100%, that is the most meaningful. For other people, I have helped people write down messages in my handwriting, mm-hmm. on whatever post-it note was in their room, or whatever piece of paper uh-huh. was in their room. Again, we need to do this. In this moment, I might be able to type it up nice later, but for their sense of completion, it needs to be done right now, and it needs to be kept in the house. So sometimes I have written word for word and read back someone's message to a loved one. With children, sometimes they'll go into artwork, and that might look like whatever they happen to be drawing. So there was a three-year-old that I would say developmentally was five, and it's around this holiday season, and they're drawing Christmas trees, and that's all they want to do. They're in another room drawing Christmas trees. This happens to be one where we don't have that permission to talk about, even though their parent is very close. So they're drawing their Christmas trees, and then they draw one for me. And I said, thank you so much for drawing one for me. I wonder if we could draw one for your parent. Then we draw one for the parent. Wonder if you could draw one for your other parent who's, you know, actively grieving at the bedside and just does not have the energy to care for or tell their child. Fortunately, they have friends who are there. So it's not that this child is being left alone. There are friends and community that are coming together trying to support them. So we draw one for them. And then, are there any words that we could put on here? Or things that we could put on the star? So maybe we put dad on one star and mom on another star, and then maybe our little leaves turn into like love, and I might have to help them write that. candy, you know, whatever that is.
Presents.
Presents. And then, oh, these are so beautiful. Why don't we go show them? Mm-hmm. And then we bring the art to the bedside, and this three-year-old can say, I made this for you, Daddy. Mm-hmm. And I made this for you, Mommy. And they can have that drawn on paper, all their materials. I did not bring anything. Mm-hmm. I did not influence, other than maybe adding the words. I was really trying to make it almost more like that child-centered play therapy, where whatever is coming up, and then maybe moving more towards, even like Ed Lyrian has a little bit of that, and then we're going to kind of influence you. So maybe going more into that Ed Lyrian where, and then they're just going to have this little bit of influence that makes it into a legacy.
And that connection too, like, mm-hmm. if you think of, I'm getting such a visual picture of as you're explaining that whole, another beautiful experience, and how you are, you know, you're making that connection of like, there's, you're going into the space and all these things are happening, and sometimes they're happening separately, and then taking something that's already going on and just moving it. Mm-hmm. So that there is that connection between that family system. So then it's just bringing that. It's just, I think of like a thread is like just what goes into my mind, and just kind of tightening it up and pulling it in closer and making those things so that they're relational connections.
Relational is the key. I've fallen in love with this idea of relational music therapy interventions. How do we make this? Because sometimes in hospice, we do make a visit with someone who may not be responsive, and maybe the family's not there, and maybe they're sleeping more. And let's say this is an initial assessment, and they're sleeping more of the day, and maybe they have small responses. Maybe they open their eyes, or these little responses that now we have to consider, are they appropriate for music therapy? And the first question that comes to my mind for myself when I'm reflecting on that is, and what does the family think about this? How is the family doing with this? How might we bring them into this space, whether they are physically present or not? So if I call a family member and I get a hold of them on the phone and they identify a meaningful song that I can then bring into the space and say, your daughter, mother, brother picked this song for you. Now this becomes relational. Now this is no longer, I am playing music and you are listening and we're looking for whatever little responses you can give today, which we sometimes have to model acceptance of that for families as well. Now, if the family is 100% okay with their condition and the patient is sleeping straight through our visits, don't keep them on music therapy. I am not endorsing, you know, trying to justify every little thing. And where can we explore the relational aspect of music therapy that may help? I've had sessions, again, all of these influence my master's degree decision.
Yes.
I've had sessions where it is all about creating a space for the family. It was all about creating a space for the children. And the patient themselves, they could sometimes mouth words to songs. Sometimes there was really no clear response. Not someone that I needed to see that often, except the family made the effort. The siblings made an effort. And the siblings didn't necessarily all have the best relationship, but the siblings made the effort to come to music therapy. They did not want to necessarily go to family therapy, but they would come to music therapy. And I think that was really my big catalyst for looking into not just music therapy master's degrees, but also potentially these other master's degrees, is because I created this space and all of these things happened, and I can't necessarily explain why. And it doesn't mean that I have to, but I want to be able to explain why and what was happening, and even to be a little bit more strategic the next time around.
Mm-hmm. Have more in your toolbox.
Have more in my toolbox.
Yes, totally.
And because I'm the one that's there. Mm-hmm. They aren't necessarily, they were all there with, I think, probably the social work initial assessment. And I don't know if they would have come for every social work visit. So they were there with the space that music therapy opened up for them. And I would love to have more information the next time to know how to not necessarily just create the space and not necessarily go too deep either without their consent. But to know what was happening and being able to name the shifts, because I can tell you that the beginning, where they weren't necessarily always nice to each other, to the end, where they're deciding on a family project around the patient who is dying, I can tell you that shift from those data points.
Yes, yeah.
And some of the pieces in the middle, I think I was missing because I just didn't have the knowledge of knowing what kind of shifts were happening.
I feel like it becomes almost like a responsibility, like a professional responsibility. Like once you start to see those, like some of those spaces, and it's like, okay, I'm aware that I'm missing these I get it. Like I see it. I see what's happening, but I need some more support. And what is the most, you know, like, especially being driven to get more information and wanting to do that. I think that's like an ethical and professional thing of like, I really want to be able to have this information for the next time that it happens. Mm-hmm. And then figuring out, especially in music therapy, which can be different than other creative arts therapies, we don't have to have a master's to practice. Mm-hmm. So we can, we're all kind of different in that under the umbrella of creative arts therapies of who has bachelor's, who has to have master's. But that can be such a confusing place. When you are, it's like, what direction do I go to get that information to fully support the clients in what they need so that I can be that better therapist to fill in those spaces?
Right.
And I think that's such a amazing, it's such a, you've painted so many beautiful pictures. I love it. Of how, you know, and I think too, for people who are listening, maybe this is like a training, you know, of like, they feel this in a different way. And it's like, I need this training, or mm-hmm. I need this other thing to add to those, to my clinical work, to like lift those spaces. Yeah, it's so awesome. Yeah. That process for you, choosing to go back and then deciding what to go back in, was it an easy process, or did you have a difficult time choosing like what degree that you wanted to go back for? What was that like for you?
I wanted to do all the degrees. If there was a way, especially financially, yeah. for me to just get a master's, yep. and it would probably be like, I would get the master's in social work and counseling and marriage and family therapy and music therapy and speech language pathology and physical therapy and probably maybe a little bit of OT. Yep. Let's just do it all. That's
where it's sampler platter.
But I want it all in depth.
Yep.
And you know, I just need a few more hours in each day and mm-hmm. I can do this work full time. You know, because I'm doing my master's degree right now and working full time. So
yes.
I am one of those stubborn, I'm going to be able to do this. I'm yep. going to make it work. And this is where self-care has become essential mm-hmm. as well. But I think also, I have been amazed by how much time I had before that I didn't realize I had before, because now I'm filling it with my master's degree. But yes, it was very challenging. And what I ended up doing to help my decision, because master's degrees usually require some kind of statement of why, I did my why statements. I wrote those essays. Mm-hmm. And I had to decide which one resonated the most. What was my main why? And that is where I made the decision.
That is an awesome process. Oh my gosh, I love that so much. That's a great concrete way. Again, I think it can be something that can get so locked in your mind of like all these ideas of like, this is important. This is important. I want more information on this. And I know I can dive down this way and this way and this way, but that's a really cool way to like bring it into, I don't know. I don't want to say reality, but like bring it out of mm-hmm. your mind and have it in front of you.
And some of it is bringing it into reality. You yeah. have to realistically look at the financial piece of it. You have to think of the personal reasoning. You have to think about, again, why I'm looking at all six masks at yes. the same time is I also had to zoom out to, and I want to be working full time. Mm-hmm. That's probably a reason why the master's in music therapy with a counseling focus wasn't going to work, outside of the fact that they don't have that in the state of California, which is, each state has different licensing processes that I know you're in the middle of.
Oh, yes. Licensure.
Yes. It's something that we aim for in music therapy, and at the same time, it's complex. Yes. And there's no clear solution for having that balance of advocacy and financial and personal time wise, yes. what can we do as professionals? But mm-hmm. Especially the state of California, which was the last state to license counseling.
Wow.
Last state.
Really?
As far as I know, someone can fact that, check that. And if they send me a message, right? I could be wrong. As far as my understanding, they were the last state. So California in many ways is progressive, and in many ways, I may just say goes in a different pace. Mm-hmm. And so we just got music therapy title protection in California this year. Hallelujah.
Well,
and
I'm gonna
take this moment really quick. Any California music therapists who are listening, have you filled out the task force survey?
Go do it. I will have a link to it in the show notes.
If you have not filled out this survey, please do. Because even though we have arrived at title protection, you can actually go to Music Therapy Chronicles and listen to Judy Simpson talk about different the different like levels of advocacy, and you will learn where title protection falls on those levels, and maybe that will help you decide to also be involved. You do not have to be a member of the task force to help. We do want you to fill out this information so that we can best represent and advocate and give data and information to legislators and legislative consultants.
Yeah.
So that we know we're doing what's in the best interest of California music therapists, and not just what's in the best interest of the music therapists on the task force.
Yes. Yeah. That is, I will put links to that as well as the Music Therapy Chronicles with Judy Simpson as well. Those are great resources. Yeah. Wow. This has been, I love how we, I don't know if it was accidental or if it just, we came full circle in the most beautiful, natural way of starting on self-care and then coming back to this really cool place. And this has been so wonderful to hear about hospice, multi-generational hospice care, family therapy, that I love how you've integrated, especially, you know, with your going back and getting your more information as you're in your graduate work, and, you know, just bringing that lens to that is so, so cool and such a rich experience it must be for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so I think so important for other therapists, not only music therapists, but other creative arts therapists to hear all of that. Music Therapy Chronicles, I think, is one of those other places that has like so many resources for, and not even, I feel like too, other, if you're not a music therapist, Music Therapy Chronicles is still a really cool podcast to check out. And because it's just really great therapists in general that you can apply, you can take so many things out of there and apply it to all of the creative arts therapy modalities. But before we sign off, you have a really cool resource that you've just made that I think also translates beyond just music therapists too, through Music Therapy Ed. Can you speak a little bit about what that resource is?
Yes, I dived in and created an e-course on funding and program development. There's a lot of creativity that goes into that as well.
Yeah.
And it dives into just really revisiting what your program looks like, whether you are an employee or a contractor, or a business owner. What do your structures look like right now? How can you work best with the people around you? And then how do you get funding? So it actually gives resources on finding funding. Some of that is music therapy focused, and I do believe it would translate across different disciplines, because some grants will not say art therapy, music therapy, and they still could apply. So the Thomas Long Foundation is an example of that. There was nothing in their mission about supporting music or music therapy. It was about supporting, I think the language was seniors.
Awesome.
And then it turned into supporting a music therapy position. So that can be a really helpful resource. And then I just received the notification that I will be presenting at the Western Region Conference.
Yay!
Taking a focus on ways to raise your funds, building support for music therapists. So I will be presenting that CMTE. In April.
Cool.
And then if there are any counselors listening, I will be presenting at the American Counseling Association. This is the national conference that's happening in San Diego this year. And I'm presenting on creative arts and play with one of my professors as a gateway for children's grief and loss processing.
Oh, that's like a topic so near and dear to my heart. All of them are, but the creative arts and play, especially for grief and for end of life support, is just, you said it earlier that, you know, it's, I think I had said it's really intensive work and you were like, but it's my favorite work. And I feel it's the exact same way of it's so meaningful and so powerful and sometimes exhausting, but just like the most beautiful, beautiful work.
I call it beautifully intense. Yeah. Whenever I talk about hospice music therapy, I go back to my alma mater, University of the Pacific, and lecture on hospice music therapy. Mm-hmm. And that's the phrase that always comes out of my mouth. Beautifully intense.
Yes, it is. And it's and self-care is very important when you're doing beautifully intense work. It really is.
No matter your population.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like I've done beautifully intense work in a different way that required different self-care too. Mm-hmm. Like it's funny how your self-care changes too, depending on if you switch populations. Or I work with like two kind of different populations. Sometimes they overlap in the middle. But then some days it's like really heavy, you know, working with children who have special needs. And I need a whole different type of self-care than when I have a day where I'm working with children with life-limiting illnesses. It's like, like, okay, that difference of do I need a nap or do I need to meditate?
There we go.
It's exactly that. Oh my goodness. Well, Brittany, can you tell us, for anyone listening who's interested in learning more about hospice care in general, if they want to reach out to you, like you said, building the community, reaching out to others. I am such a proponent of that. And I encourage anybody listening, reach out, because everybody's so friendly and usually just loves talking about this stuff. So where can our listeners find you and get in contact with you?
So I'm on Instagram, slowly building my music therapy profile under Brittany.mtbc. LinkedIn will show you all of the different things that I've worked on. Facebook, and I can probably just send you my email and
perfect.
You can post that in the show notes too.
Absolutely. Yes. This is going to be such a full show notes. Anyone who's listening, just go check it out and click on, I encourage you to just try and click on one thing at least. So it's my favorite when this was actually my most recent one that I posted was Melissa Diaz. And she explained it as a spider web. And I think it's such a great way to explain it. And just even clicking on a show note is like making that spider web bigger for, you know, making those connections. You never know what's going to happen. And just more information. So I love it. Well, Brittany, this has been so, so amazing. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you guys haven't checked out the show notes yet, I highly encourage you to do so. There are tons of links in there for resources that Brittany mentions throughout this episode. Also, Brittany was kind enough to send me a picture of the mask intervention as well as self-care practice that she describes at the beginning of this episode. This is going to go out in my January newsletter. So if you haven't signed up for that yet, you can do so at creativetherapyumbrella.com/newsletter. It goes out once a month and is full of podcast resources, additional intervention ideas, and just up-to-date stuff that's happening over here at Creative Therapy Umbrella. Thank you guys so much for listening, and be creative.